everybody, and welcome to Roll It, a movie podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Ryan, and with me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Ty Lohr. How you doing, Ty?
What's up, man? How's it going?
It's going all right. Besides, it's 10 o'clock right now, at night. 10 o'clock at night, so we'll see if I can...
It's a bit of an exaggeration, though, right? It's 9:59.
Okay, you're right. Fair. But we'll see if I can stay awake. I'll be doing pretty good. But at the moment, I'm doing all right. But... this week we're doing two new releases in a row. 2 weeks ago we did Killers of the Flower Moon. This week we're just doing one killer. We're doing The Killer, the 2023 film directed by David Fincher, starring Michael Fassbender as the titular killer. So Ty, what did you think about this movie?
Yeah, I mean, so I started off the movie and I was like, oh, this is not what I thought it would be. In like an excited way. I was like, all right, this is going to be interesting. And then it turned out to be exactly kind of what I was thinking it would be. but I like the, I liked the inner dialogue more than heavy dialogue, you know, I like the monologue and like the inner thoughts. I think it did more for character development. And I kind of like the, I like the absence or mostly absence kind of sound to build up the tensions and stuff. It was fine. I mean, I'm not like crazy about it. It was very like, it was cool. It was like an average movie for me. Nothing crazy. You know, it's not like going to be super memorable by my standard, but I mean, what do you think? Was it, were you blown away by it? Am I just,
I don't know if I was blown away. Like, it's not top tier Fincher. But it's pretty good. I would say, I mean, you know, we're talking about at least a four, maybe 4.5 out of 5.
See, it just didn't do much for me.
I mean, hey, different strokes for different folks. But I just love the, first of all, I love the first, whatever, 20, 25 minutes, that initial chapter.
Yes.
You know, you're just sitting there. It's
totally
it's
agree.
A super slow, you know, super slow build up. It's you're kind of building tension, but it's also just like you're just sitting with this guy. And I was I'll reference this a few times in this episode, but there I just got my Sight and Sound magazine for December, and there's an interview with. Last time I was referencing a Sight and Sound interview with Scorsese.
Yeah, I know.
Now there's a Sight and Sound interview.
So when's the sponsorship coming?
I know, right? I wish I could get a free free membership for a year for a sponsorship. But anyway, there's a little interview with Fincher, an article with Fincher about this movie in there, and where did I even? Where was I going with that? Holy smokes. This is the late.
There was
the late start does to me.
You were talking. Yeah, I know, man. It's rough. Anytime after 8:30, dude, you might as well be shutting her
shut down. Shut
down
the brain.
No, you were talking about the first initial chapter, kind of the thought process, the inner monologue there, the first 20 minutes of the movie, and then you transitioned to talking about the interview in Sight and Sound.
Yeah. Boy, and I cannot...
And I think you were going to maybe connect
it. I'm sure I was, but I don't remember how. But maybe I'll think about it at some point. But anyway, yeah, I just love that. Like you said, we get introduced to the voiceover and almost nothing else besides some, you know, some Smith songs that he listened to on his iPad or his iPod Nano.
Yeah.
But besides that, all we're hearing is him talking and looking through the window. And a very, very clear homage to Rear Window, the Hitchcock movie, and you're kind of getting this feeling of, you know, seeing everything through his eyes. You know, there's a great shot where I just mentioned him listening to the Smiths on his iPod Nano, and there's a great shot where you see you're looking. Effectively, you're looking through his binocular or scope. I guess it's a scope because it's just a single, but it's not connected to the gun or anything. He's just looking through the scope. But
right,
you're looking through that, and you're looking at the window. Just like Cary Grant in Rear Window, and you're watching the guy, you know, people move across through the room and down on the sidewalk and everything. But anyway, when you're looking through that, you're hearing, you know, the music going, you're hearing the song, and then it cuts back to the office space that he's in, and you can hear it in his headphones.
Yeah.
You know, you can just hear the headphones going, and you're watching him looking, and then you go back inside, and then the music's loud again, and then it kind of bounces back and forth a couple times. I just love that, because it's like setting you, it's like letting you know, hey, this whole movie is a subjective point of view. It's all through his eyes. It's all narrated by him. So it's like, how reliable is this narrator? How much are you supposed to trust what he's saying versus what he's doing? And, you know, it's setting the tone for the whole thing of being like, hey, you're going to be in this guy's shoes the whole time. And minus about, I don't know, maybe 6, 8, 10 seconds, something like that at maximum, when he's got the secretary in the car, when he goes inside the house to open the garage door, and you know she shakes her hands and then she lets out a scream, and when she's in the van, that's literally the only time in the whole movie when you're not with him. The whole movie is, which I might want to bring up later, of like, why does she get the only 6 seconds of the movie that Michael Fassbender's not on screen? but yeah, you're literally with him the whole movie. It's a totally subjective movie, and you're seeing everything through his eyes. You see, you know, what he thinks of himself, you know, at the beginning, he's like, I'm one of the few, you know, that takes advantage of the many.
Yeah.
And, all this stuff. And
I do like how that went through, like the monologue throughout was my favorite part.
I think it worked great. And then, you know, and then slowly you're seeing this kind of, you know, forbid empathy, stick to the plan, forbid empathy. And you slowly, mm-hmm. you know, you're seeing him do the actions he takes aren't the, you know, the credos.
It's everything opposite
of the
first mantra.
Yeah, it's not the credos and the stuff
repeated.
That he keeps repeating throughout. He says forbid empathy, and I mean, it's the the least empathetic thing you could possibly do. But when he kills the woman, you know, before she's like, oh, I have, you know, if I know what you can do and how you can make things look, but like, you know, my kids need taken care of, so just don't make it look, you know, make it look like it's an accident or, you know, don't make it look bad. So he's like, well, I'll snap your neck and push you down the stairs, and then your kids will get your life insurance policy. So it's like, he says forbid empathy, but he shows it a little, I mean, and then the whole, I mean, that's one example, but literally
the whole movie is all about empathy.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, really, if he wanted to stick to the plan, and he would just say, when he gets back in his, whatever, girlfriend, whatever she is, and he sees her in the hospital, like, sticking to the plan, forbid empathy, would be like, all right, well, this is, that's unfortunate. I guess I'll see you later. My bags of money in every single storage facility in every state and every country in the world, and you know, I'll be all right. But the whole, movie is fueled by his, I mean, it's revenge, but also like feelings and emotions and the things he says 100%. He's not influenced by in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, so like he repeatedly says, stick to your plan, anticipate, don't improvise. And the entire movie is improvising.
Yeah.
I mean, sure.
But he's
but
got
like,
plans when he does each thing. He's got plans. You know,
I
you
guess,
can tell.
But
like, as soon
not
as he gets
really,
to the airport,
though. He has
he
to
picks
improvise
up a van.
Things.
He takes
he,
the
because
van
he couldn't
to the, you know, to his storage facility. He knows exactly, you know what I mean? He knows what he's doing. He buys the garbage can and the nail gun, to go to the office to get, you know what I mean?
I guess, but everything's contrasted with the, like his the perfectionist in
him.
Oh,
yeah.
The control freak in him is always up against the spontaneous, improvising, person too. Like, sure, he has those things set out in a plan, but
he's kind of improvising.
Like,
the plan.
How are you gonna get into the? Yeah, exactly. But how are you gonna get into the building? And then once you get in there, like, he does the nail gun, and he's like, whatever, 150-pound man, like that should do. But it doesn't. He kills like, him way too fast. Same thing with the pit bull. You know, like everything. Like, sure, he does stick to the plan, but his plan, and you could argue, is to improvise.
Yeah, he's improvising a plan, and exactly, that's a good way of putting it. But yeah, and like you said, all of his or a bunch of his calculations are just wrong.
Yeah,
and a lot, you know, some of them are right. You know, he's like counting the door, how many seconds it takes for the door to close so he can get in there before, you know, the FedEx guy catches him, and stuff like that, where he's like, you can tell he's like, he knows what he's doing, but it's also, you could, like, that's why you don't improvise. Sometimes it works out, and sometimes the dog, you know, awakens, or sometimes the guy's in the shower when you think he's in the bedroom, and some, you know, it's all this, or the guy dies when you shoot him in the heart with a nail gun.
Which, like, come on, surprise, surprise.
No, it's just so funny. It's like, you know, whatever, a 65-year-old man, he goes through all this and he's like dead by the time he gets to the end of the explanation.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I think, I don't know what you thought, but I think this movie is pretty funny.
Oh, yeah, I think the entire thing is almost like a comical look at a hitman, right? Like, when I said, maybe I should clarify my opening statement there. So when I said at the beginning, I was like, oh, this is going to be different than what I've always thought it was going to be. Because it was like definitely a single person perspective. Or, you know, the perspective of the killer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing like I was thinking it was going to be all about the monotony in that waiting period, or about like what happens in that, or like his controlled life, you know what I mean? And then it opens up to just be kind of John Wick-esque in a way. But it's like the antithesis of that
very
to an extent, because it's just like,
Because so, instead of a like almost semi-god figure of like, this just like unreal person who can do anything, this guy's kind of, he's good at it, but he's also crumbling, and he's also not as good as he thinks he is. You know, he thinks he's like, I'm, you know, Ted Williams batted 344 in whatever Lifetime or something like that. And he's like, I'd be batting 1,000 if, you know, if I counted the guy that,
if it weren't for
the guy who let red meat and mare's stress do the job for me. You know, he thinks he's like perfect. And then as soon as he gets done talking about all this stuff, boom, he screws up. And then it's kind of just goes from there, where he's like, well, he's not as perfect or infallible as he thinks he is. And I think you get to that at the end. I think that's the important piece at the end of the movie, both the final scene with Arliss Howard and his last monologue when he's sitting on the beach with his, you know, girlfriend or partner or whatever. And
I you know, and I think that the entire thing is in a way humanizing somebody who has been deemed by movies, entertainment headlines, like non-human. And he even starts off like very, and I don't know, not to say that I think humanizing killers is good, but like, I, you know, starting off, it's very like Dexter-esque, you know, it's like the gloves and the squirting after brushing his teeth and routine. And even like the watch ticks, and every whatever 10 minutes he changes positions. And that first time when he doesn't hear his watch go off, or he silences it, that it, you kind of see like, oh, that's a misstep, you know? And then what's that going to do? And then it leads to a bunch of other missteps. And then, you know, he's like, and I don't give an F. But he did. The entire rest of the movie was him doing just the opposite of what he just said and repeating this mantra, like, stick to the plan, don't improvise. But improvising is in the plan. I mean, like, it's so counter. What his monologue is saying and what his actions are doing are almost so counter to each other that it works really well to kind of make this person like a complex human that's just after the like affection, or you know, he has like just the same amount of emotions as anybody else or more. Mm-hmm. You know, probably more, yeah, I think, and you could argue,
yeah, and exactly, and yeah, even though he's saying he doesn't, or he doesn't think he does, you know, have any of these emotions,
yeah,
or at least that's what he's telling himself. But he just has.
It's what he wants the audience to
think.
That's
what he. Yeah, exactly. But he just says, all you realize by the end is that he has just zero self-reflection. And that either zero self-reflection or he doesn't want to admit what he does know. But it seems like it's just no self-reflection until the very end when, like, that last monologue, I wonder what you think about this, is. You know, he's talking about, like, you know, the only life path is the one behind you, fate,
yeah, I was just gonna bring that
all
up.
That stuff. And then he says, but maybe you're not one of the few. Maybe you're like me. Maybe you're one of the many, which is the opposite of what he says at the beginning. What did you think about that? And does it tie in to his interaction with Arliss Howard? In that final, you know, in the penthouse, and what about his little after he says that, you see him sitting there, and then the final shot is him like his face flinching. So what do you think about all that put together? I know that's a lot, but give me your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I like that idea of you know, the only life path is the one behind you, and I think the movie, the script of this movie is like the best part for me, I think. The inner dialogue, which I guess is a monologue, right? Or no, it's not. I don't know.
No, it wouldn't be. It's not a monologue.
He's having a conversation. Yeah, because he's kind of having a conversation with himself. But a lot of it is like a monologue, an inner monologue.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
His mantra is, you know, just repeating this mantra to himself every time, every day, routine, routine, routine. But I think the idea of the life path is the only one behind you, like, you see this change throughout the movie. Him changing as a person from the few to the many. And you could view that in many different ways, you know? Like, at the beginning, this routine in cold, I guess, hardness reflected by like the color scheme and where he's at and lonely, and it, the movie generally kind of gets more colorful, especially, and then at the end, it's like, if you compare that first scene and the last scene, it's almost like from lonely and cold to fulfilling that love and being whole in a way. So maybe the life path to love, you know, you could see it that way, or changing from the few to the many is, or from the, yeah, few to the many could be viewed as a type of way of like, acceptance, self-acceptance in that, you know? I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question though. I think I might need to think on that a little bit longer. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like in terms of like the quotes, he's, you know, like the life path thing and the fate thing. I think that's, he's kind of like calling that out of being like, yeah, that's BS. That's just lies I was telling myself. I think the flinch, that little flinch in his face or his eye twitches. It seems like how I read that is he's like, he's saying this now, he thinks he's got it figured out, but he knows, no, that's what I got to do. That's, you know, that's what I'm meant to do, is be a killer. You know, that's my job. That's what I'm good at. And it, like, he won't be able to stay away. He can't just leave it behind.
But it almost kind of felt like to me too, is like he killed, like he went on this killing spree, right? But he also killed the person that he used to be by changing all of that.
Yeah. But that's why, and if he didn't flinch at the end, that's how I would read it. But he flinches.
Yeah, I guess.
And it's like, but him, I mean, like,
look at the title though. The only there, you know, the eye is down. Almost like, you know what I mean? If you want to be that into it, I guess. If you want to dive that deep on it.
Yeah. But I think
you're like, but I don't.
I just don't. I just think that little twitch, I think, is pretty relevant to his future activities, I guess. I don't think he'll be able to stay away. Even though he thinks he's done with his old past. You know, he thinks he can put it behind him and kill, you know, and
right.
put that to bed and killed it. But he can't, I don't think. Anyway, I think that ties in the few and the many and all that stuff ties in with his conversation in the penthouse when that's kind of, he realizes, you know, he breaks into this guy's house to kill him. Well, to see, because when he's going up in the elevator, he's like, when I look into his eyes, I'll know what I need to do. So he comes into this guy's house with a gun, and the guy, Arliss Howard, which I think he's the client, is his title in this movie.
Yeah.
But he's like, he thinks he's robbing him, and he just has no thought. He's like, Michael Fassbender's like, you don't know why I'm here? And he's like, no. And man, he like spells it out to him, and he's like, oh my gosh, you know, and
Saint Domingo guy.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, I don't know how any of this works. They just told me to like take, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, and that's kind of Fassbender realizing, like, this guy, I'm an afterthought to this guy. Like, I think what I'm doing is the most important thing in the world. And, you know, I think that I hold this power, but like, this guy is really one of the few. You know, he can, you know, he's got the, you know, the stock market stuff behind him on the TV or whatever. And,
which is the most like, non-subliminal subliminal edition I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, they should.
It's just like, how do we let him know what he does without telling everybody what he does? It's like, just throw up like two or three screens and make it all stocks and like say stocks often on it.
But like that's kind of the it's like Michael Fassbender realizing, like, no, this guy's, you know, he really doesn't have. He really could like care less, could not care less about me. Like, I'm not even a speck on his radar. You know, he wouldn't have been the one that ordered my killing. You know, it was totally irrelevant to him. He just was like doing what.
Yeah.
And it throws into contrast, like, you know, the whole movie, you're like, well, this guy's a sociopath, Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
But then at the end, it's like, well, no, maybe. This uber wealthy, like, multi-billionaire, maybe he's the sociopath. And it's kind of like, you know, it's Fassbender coming face to face with like the opposite side of like the, you know, the other type of sociopath. It's like, well, maybe this guy's not literally shooting people in the head for money, but like his decisions to make money are, you know, probably making lots of people's lives worse. Or, you know, he's like, and obviously he's willing to buy a killer to kill somebody that would, you know, up his bottom line, I'm sure.
Right.
But it's like, no, this guy's probably way worse for the world than Michael Fassbender. And then that's kind of where the last, like, little dialogue comes from.
Especially
from being like, no, maybe a, because at the beginning he thinks he's one of the few taking it, you know, exacting his will on every, you know, the many. But right. then he realizes he's just part of the cog in the machine that's being used by the actual, like, wealthy, rich, the few.
And, I mean, you realize, too, like, the few and the many idea, I think, can be viewed in a bunch of different ways. I definitely think you hit the nail on the head with that. Like, he viewed himself as the executioner, literally and also figuratively, of like, if without him, nothing would be, these things wouldn't be possible. Sure, that's true in a sense, but then he realizes that he, like you said, he's just a cog in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he is the only reason that he thinks that he is, like, where he's at in his life, or that he has as much power as he does. It's almost like a falsely perceived power.
Exactly.
But I mean, but at the same time, he is the one killing people. So it's, I don't know how falsely perceived that power
right,
is.
Right. But exactly that point, he's at the end, or not the end, at the beginning, he's like, it's, I think it's during that initial, like, 20 minutes when he's talking about, like, yeah, I just do a job, for the money. But, you know, if I didn't do it, somebody else would. And it's when he's talking about, right. like, my actions don't even put a dent in the population. Like, 4 million people are born every second. You know, so stuff like
yeah.
that. And it's like, it brings that to a point at the end where it's like, well, his actions aren't, maybe things would happen without him, and the world would keep turning for better or worse. And he realizes mm-hmm. he's not, you know, he's not the all-important one that he was kind of playing up to begin with, that he thought at the beginning, like, that he was effectively playing God. But anyway, so it kind of ties together. Even though at the beginning he's like, well, I don't put a dent in it, I'm just doing my job. But still, he's the way he talks about himself, there's an air of self-importance, and, you know, like, I'm very good at this. And at the end he's like, well, you know, maybe not, maybe I don't really, it doesn't really matter. But anyway, so, like, speaking of that, to jump off that, there's a popular way of reading this film, is through the lens of David Fincher as the killer. And that he's, you know, this, kind of exacting perfectionist that needs to have everything just so, and, you know, can't stand it when things aren't right. You know, he has the reputation of doing 100 takes on scenes, and needing, you know, needing to have the actors do exactly the right thing at exactly the right time and exactly what he's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's kind of, you know, brushed this aside, and from what I've seen, when he's been asked about it. And, you know, in that Sight and Sound article he talks about, he's like, well, you know, of course you can't just go into something, you know, you can't just go into a film being, you know, whatever happens, happens. Well, I guess some people do. They're, like, very famously, Terrence Malick, my guy, Terrence Malick, director of your favorite movie, Tree of Life. But, you know, there's stories of him, you know, he just, like, they'll be shooting a scene and he'll just turn the camera up and, like, you know, shoot, you know, 3 minutes of birds flying in the air. And they're like, the actor's like, did you get that? And he's like, and somebody will say, no, he was just filming those birds, or filming the grass or something. And like, but for the most part, most directors can't, there needs to be some kind of, you know, set plan. You know, you got to do this, and it's going to go like this, or else it's just probably going to be a mess. And it's, he talks about that and he's like, yeah, you need that. But like, I don't know any director who wouldn't turn down like, you know, perfect, you know, a happy accident, as you could say. So, you know, you take those, but it's like, yeah, I have to be, you know, he didn't use the word perfectionist, but he's like, yeah, I have to have a plan and know what I'm doing. But I'm not going to like turn down a little bit of, you know, a little bit of wiggle, I guess, if something is, you know, works out. But anyway, to tie this into what I was talking about earlier, even in a broader sense, is kind of seeing it as he's in the scene with Fassbender and Howard at the end in the penthouse. It's kind of like him, is Fincher coming face to face with like the studio execs. And, you know, Fincher's thinking, you know, like, he's the auteur. He has the, you know, the power of the director and to make these great pieces of art and these great films. And then when he comes face to face with the studio execs and like, oh, yeah, like, these guys have the power. They have the wallet. They ultimately make the decisions. And I'm just a cog in their machine. Even though I try to do right. what, like, I make these great works of art and I you know, try to be a perfectionist and do my job extremely well. And he does, you know, he makes lots of great movies, but he's like, well, I'm still in this system that's controlled by a wallet. I don't fund, you know, I'm not going to fund my own movies. They're funded by, this was funded by Netflix, you know? So he's got these major companies cutting him checks to do his job. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, I can see the similarity. So that's, there's, you know, there's multiple reasons why it's a popular reading, I think, to see, you know, the, which is, I feel like that can be read into a lot of films. Like, oh, this movie's actually about the director or the writer. So it can be a lazy take, but I think it is there in this one.
I see what you're saying. I think, you know, I don't think it's a lazy take. I think
it can be
in
some movies
in that regard,
in some movies.
But especially in this movie with, in this movie in particular, I feel like Fincher's, almost reminding himself that the more you strive for the control, the more, the more things that you feel like are controlled, the more you'll have to improvise. And there's a healthy mix between the two. And it doesn't have to be one way or another. It's not reckless or it's not reckless versus you know, strategically tactic. It's more like finding the balance in those two things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when you're an ultimate perfectionist, it only makes things. Nah, I mean, obviously, it's gonna make things tougher when you want everything perfect, but it's like it can make more problems for you. And I'm sure that is, you know, is on his mind. Like, you know, when he asked for the 100th take, it's like, well, it's only gonna cause more problems down the road.
I mean that all. Like, you know, from a director's point of view, it's like all that does is add more room for error with the in the editing room.
More room for error in the editing room and more fatigue on the actors. So they might screw up more later in later scenes because they're, you know, tired of this or, you know, they're losing their steam or whatever.
I think a relevant thing for me in my experience is like, you know, like whenever I was a photojournalist, I would go out on these assignments, and oftentimes, depending on what I was shooting, obviously, but oftentimes, the photos I took earlier in the assignment. Now, this is all depending on, you know, what have you, like what it was and what was happening, and if things developed more as I was there or whatever. But oftentimes, it's the earlier first shots that I saw, you know, whatever it was, the composition was there, or I like the lighting there or whatever. Those are the shots that I always came back to, even though I might have shot 400 photos in a 20-minute event, right? But it's like that first 10 that I'm really looking through in the editing process.
Mm-hmm.
And all I did by shooting the other ones, I mean, in essence, you know, like on one hand, it's like, yeah, that's more practice. So you're just going to get, you're going to, you know, the more shots you shoot, the more you're going to get, the more you're going to make. Right. Mm-hmm. But, I know I'm mixing analogies because you're like, are you talking about photography shots or basketball? I was talking about hockey, really, but nobody knows that. I don't know what I'm talking about now, but I think like the idea of the balance, is kind of like, I mean, you could look at this movie as a balance between, like killing and the love for life, you know, like he is a cool blooded killer, but he also has this, drive or empathy toward life too, that he comes across at the end. So maybe the few is the outlook he carried at the beginning and the many is the outlook that he carried at the end.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
I digress. Sure.
I did want to bring this up. There is, because I did watch it because I was inspired to, I wanted to do the little bit of background for this movie, but one of the major influences on this movie is, the French film Les Samurai, by Jean-Pierre Melville. And it's kind of like the prototypical kind of like, I guess godfather of this movie, this type of movie of the, you know, which this, obviously this movie kind of, subverts a little bit by making him not necessarily calm, cool, and collected, more like kind of losing his marbles a little bit. But like gets paid, kills, and you know, things happen from there. But there's, it's like he's just either trying to lose a tail, trying to, you know, all this, like all these, this process of being a hitman, but he's just like, you know, zero about him. And yeah, this movie's kind of doing, it's playing with that, where he seems like this, you know, at the beginning, he's like, this guy's just like cool as a cucumber. And he's, you know, talking about all,
controls heart.
Yeah. And all this stuff. Exactly. Controls his heartbeat to make sure he's, you know, when he's going to kill somebody, his heartbeat isn't above 60.
Yeah.
And all this stuff. But then that veneer, you know, it gets ripped away pretty fast of being like, no, this guy does not have it all together. He is not, you know, the samurai that we've seen in the past. He's kind of losing it. You know, he's in Les Samurai, there's like a, you know, I mentioned that the most of the movie he's trying to, like, he's getting tailed and followed, and he's trying to, like, you know, dodge these these either police or other hitmen and stuff like that. And he's actually being followed, you know, you're seeing these people.
Yeah.
And in this, you know, you have the scene when he's at the airport and he thinks he's being followed, and it's the guy with like those, he notices the socks and he's just like uber paranoid. And I don't think that guy had anything to do with anything, you know, it was just some random guy. And, you know, he sets the glass on the door handle and the tin from the room service on the ground, so it's like an alarm, and he sleeps in the chair with a knife.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, this is normal behavior, even for a hitman. But it's just like showing how like paranoid he is, and not even rightly so. You know, there's the shots of him in the airplane and the aisle seat when he's got his headphones in, you just see his head poking out from the chairs. From behind the chair in front of him, like looking to see if somebody's coming on the plane, you know, waiting for somebody to come after him. And just, you know,
I mean, the thing that I didn't know about this movie. Yeah. The thing that I didn't know about this movie is it's a comedy.
Yeah. It very much
is. I mean, if there was a such thing as slow burn comedy, it's this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is.
You know, it's.
And it is. It's
like.
It's funny because, like you mentioned, you like the script, and it's written by Andrew Kevin Walker, who is also the writer for Seven, and I think he did passes on Fight Club and The Game. So I think he's pretty tight with Fincher. Obviously, you know, he's had at least a hand in four of his scripts. That off the top of my head, maybe more, but I know those ones. So, you know, he's familiar with this type of, you know, this type of like grisly subject matter, and to kind of play with that in a funny way. Because like Seven, I mean, that's a rough movie, but there's also like moments of like, you know, I wouldn't say it's not a comedy, but there's moments of like laughter of, you know, with like, mainly with like Brad Pitt's character in that.
Yeah.
But definitely, and I mean, this very much so, there's definitely laugh moments in this.
Dude.
Very intentionally.
Come on. It's like, it almost like, whenever I was watching it, all I could think about is there's moments in like John Wick where you kind of want to laugh, but you're like, I know that wasn't supposed to be funny.
Oh, I very much disagree. John Wick is a comedy. You're supposed to laugh.
All right. All right. But like, I felt like in this movie, it was almost just like, you know, hey, he's trying, dude. All right. He's still a human, you know, like, is he the best hitman? No, everybody makes mistakes, but look at him. He's out there trying and he never gives up. And that's really all we can ask for.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of the gist I got of it. But it's funny because, like, I think they...
A neo-noir thriller type. And, yeah, I mean, I view this more as, like, a... maybe just... I almost just view it as a comedy. Like, it's a slow-burn comedy, man. I mean, I wouldn't really even say it's a thriller movie. Because
no,
I never
thriller.
Felt...
There's, just...
there's no edginess. There's nothing when you're anticipating... you know what I mean? Like, there's no...
It's all about process. There's no, you're not, I mean, sometimes you're like, oh, what's he gonna do? But there's not,
if anything, it's more of like a, methodological, like,
it's all about process and shoe leather and him, you know, watching him do the work of what it entails and all that stuff. Definitely. It's just a neo-noir with, you know, a very solid sprinkling of comedy, I would say.
Dude, a heavy amount.
I did want to bring this up. There's obviously a lot in this about, you know, kind of our modern culture and mainly like, corporatism and consumerism. Because, you know, we see McDonald's, we see FedEx, I think it's FedEx, not UPS. One of those two.
Yeah, it's FedEx.
You know, he's literally staking out for a murder in a abandoned WeWorked office. And there, like, he picks up a package from Amazon. So it's like how inundated we are with, you
Home
know,
Depot.
Yeah, Home Depot.
Curbside pickup.
Curbside pickup from Home Depot.
Dude, that's what I'm saying. Hey, this movie's a comedy, dude. I love it. I mean, like, that in that regard, I love it. Like, in overall moviness, yeah, I'm sticking with my 5 out of 10. It's middle of the road. It's fine.
Man.
But, yeah, wild, dude, it is funny. Dude, I don't think it's that wild. It's 2 hours.
Yeah.
Of, like... It's a slow burn to me, man, and I feel like I say that about every freaking movie. And
slow burns are good, Ty. It's all right.
I know, but
wrong.
I just came off of 2 stupid long movies, and I'm saying that this 2 hour one, it felt like a 3 hour film. You know, I'm just saying, man. I know. Hot take.
You just can't appreciate slow burns. Your attention span has been shredded to ribbons.
Dude, blame it on the ADHD, dog. I don't know what to say. But that's the funny thing, though. I'll sit through 3 hours of Oppenheimer twice and love it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to me either, Ryan. I'm just who I am, okay? I can't change
who
I am, Ryan. I am
who I
am.
As Popeye says, I am who I am.
I am who I am.
But anyway, but I just thought, you know, it's kind of talking like it's like about that our current or modern society is kind of almost built for sociopaths. you know, the you can kind of go through the world anonymously, you know, like you said, curbside pickup. You know, he just grabs his McDonald's to go, and all this stuff of he orders a package on Amazon and gets delivered to a Amazon pickup station. Yeah. And it's all the stuff he does to get into places, like, you know, signs up for the gym membership on, you know, through self-service on,
yeah,
you know, like a kind of a self-service checkout.
It's like almost one less interaction. Void of, maybe it's like a commentary of like the void of community or human, like the human touch, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
You know, and even being a hitman from that far away in the distance, you know, you could view that as like the same thing, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of saying like, hey, are we all a little bit like, do we right. all have a little sociopath in us that we, you know, have built society to function like this, where not only like, you know, all that, but just like the... That in that article, he talks. Fincher talks about like.
Yeah, here you go. That's what we were. Are you remembering
this? Well, I don't know if this was from the. Anyway, doesn't matter. But he talks about like. He was like, wouldn't it be wild if he was talking to his Walker, his Andrew Kevin Walker's writer, and they were talking. He's like, wouldn't it be crazy if there was like this, you know, like if he could just copy the, you know, fob to get in to into the building, and he's like, do they even make those? And Walker was like, well, let me look, I'll get back to you. And like 20 minutes later, he sends him a text, and it's a link to Amazon. It's a fob copier, and and he's like, this will scare the crap out of you, and you'll never want to stay in a hotel room again that now that you know this exists. Like, this is terrifying. And it's like the ease, how we've built society, and, you know, in a way that kind of facilitates, I don't know if danger is the right word, but kind of facilitates through its ease, it makes it easier for us to be harmed or to harm each other, you know? And the repercussions of, you know, kind of this, kind of allowing everything to be, corporatized or consumerized or capitalized on, like that Amazon can just like sell a fob copier. It's like, why would Amazon need to sell a fob copier if not for unscrupulous means, or, you know what I mean? Stuff like that, where it's, and you know, there are, you know, valid reasons, I'm sure, but you know what I mean? It's like, it's like, how much are, and kind of, I mean, it makes Arliss Howard, the super mega billionaire, you know, very much coded as such, the kind of head villain of being like, well, he's part of like this culture that's pushed these things of, you know, of giving all this stuff to the society, of like making all this stuff easy to get, easy to grab, easy to kind of disappear. Right. You know, like he does throughout the movie, of like getting into these disguises and stuff like that. And like just avoiding any kind of personal human interaction, and how easy that is in the world. And hey, I mean, I'm the first guy to go to the self-checkout when I got the choice. But it does kind of bring that to question, like, are we turning ourselves into more of a sociopathic society by constructing our society like this in terms, you know, like, I don't know. It's a question.
It is, man. It's definitely a question by every means of the word. What is lost when what, like, I don't want to call it human decency, but like, what is lost when the human touch, or when, you know what I'm saying? Like,
when, yeah, when humanity is taken out of, when humanity is taken out of society, when we're, when instead of interacting with humans, we're interacting with corporations,
and when it becomes such
businesses,
when methodology overruns, or, you know, maybe it's like, I'm just walking straight through my thought process right now. You're in my brain.
Just like Michael Fassbender, man. I'm in your brain.
Like, you know, what is what's the cost when everything is so streamlined, right? Like curbside pickup and self-service. Like when the perfectionism or the best parts or what am I trying to say? Like, when the work is whittled down to be a just a machine, right? Or just a means to an
efficiency.
End.
Efficiency. It's all about efficiency.
Yeah, when efficiency overrides organic improvisation, humanity. What is lost? And I think the answer is humanity. That.
Yeah.
Because what is humanity if not a bunch of unanticipated improvised things that are almost against the plan, to just go back to that mantra, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that I think that makes sense. Ooh. I'm thinking that
man, my brain's a little overheated, dude, off that. We're gonna listen to that back, and I'm just gonna be like, it's gonna be like one of those Liberty Mutual commercials where you're just like, what's he even saying? Blah, 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 blah. Entire time.
I should bring up, it's based on a French graphic novel. Started, I think the first, it was first published back in 1998, I want to say. And it's like long running, so it's, I think it's still going on. Or it recently stopped, but anyway, this is only, it's like very loosely based on it, and like only the first little bit. But I did want to mention that, based on, by, of the same name, it's called The Killer by Alexis Nolent and Luc Jacquemont. I think that's most of what I want to talk about. I loved, I know you didn't love this movie, so I don't know how many scenes you loved, but I mean, I loved
it. I mean, I wouldn't say, I don't want to say I didn't love the movie. It was just
you said it was middling.
Dude, it was just a movie to me. It wasn't, it didn't.
So you didn't love it. You didn't love it. It was okay.
I didn't, you're right. I didn't love it. But I didn't hate it, though. I don't, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's middling for you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I wanted to, I love the scene with, you know, Tilda Swinton. I thought that was a great, you know, across the dinner table scene. And it seems like he's about to crack, you know, like every time, you know, the whole time she's talking, you're like, what's, you know, he's going to say something here. And he almost does, but he kind of keeps it together. And then he finishes the job, and kills her. And then, what'd you think about the knockdown drag out fight with the brute in Florida?
Yeah, I liked, I mean, what's he say? The Sunshine State. So nice to have so many like-minded individuals in one place or something like that. I thought that was kind of like, no, I like that scene, you know, that's kind of like, the only scene really when he's met with opposition. To his job, where, like, and again, that is the, you know, just to bring it back to like this conflict in his mantra, it is, nothing could have been planned for in that. It's literally a fight. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he planned to kill the guy and he executed that, but everything that happened between the start and the finish had to be improvised.
Right. Yeah. Most notably, when he,
I'm glad he didn't kill the dog, though. I do want to say that.
When he, probably the funniest part in that whole sequence is when he's hiding behind like the island or whatever and opens up the drawer and it's like trying to find a knife or something. He grabs a cheese grater.
Yeah.
And he like rolls it. He's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love it. And but then he improvises and he uses that to like make a noise on the other side of the kitchen, so he gets the guy to shoot over there. No, I know it's like I said, he does not do any of the things he says he's doing, or is any of the things he says he is. You know.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, I like this movie a lot. I think it works really well. I love, you know, the best part is just all that shoe leather and process, you know, when you're watching him go, you know, go to the storage unit and, you know, grabs a license plate, grabs the bag of, you know, credentials and cash, and you know, go to the Home Depot, grab a, you know, trash bin and a nail gun. Just like watching the whole process of, but not even like when he's doing the things, that's not even the best part. It's just watching like how he's like,
like, you know, the mundane aspects nature of
like what he has to do, yeah, to do this job and like how set up he is.
Yeah.
And I guess you'd call that a little bit of world building, but yeah, anyway, I love that.
I really enjoyed all of those aspects in that movie. Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was I mean it's a fine movie, dude. I don't know. You know? It's good. Nothing more, nothing less. It's fine.
Hey, you know, it's okay to be wrong every once in a while, Ty.
yourself of that, Ryan. Remind yourself.
No, forbid empathy, Ty. I am one of the few. We don't know what we're doing next week, do we? Probably not.
No, absolutely not.
We barely fit this one in time.
I don't even know what I did last week, dude, if I'm being honest.
We'll figure something out.
We always do.
Until then, how can people find us, Ty? Unlike the killer, we're on the grid.
Yes, we are.
Wait. I got one more thing to say. Did you catch all the names that he was using for all of his fake IDs? We're all... names of, you know, 70s sitcom characters. Thought that was pretty funny.
No, yeah. I did not notice that. That is Archie Bunker,
Sam Malone. Yeah, it was every one of them was a sitcom character's name. But
that's gotta funny.
Brush up on your 70s sitcoms, Ty.
Dude, I barely have enough time to watch one movie every 2 weeks. I can't incorporate 70s sitcoms now. Come on, you're getting too crazy on me, right?
But anyway. So, unlike the anonymous nature of the killer reminded me of that. So,
very unlike Archie Bunker, you can find us pretty much anywhere on social media, unless like you're on Facebook and stuff. But we're at Roll It Podcast on Instagram and Twitter or X. I don't know what we're calling it nowadays. It's always going to be Twitter, I think. But you can get a hold of us on there, catch up with us, share your thoughts on the movies, give us suggestions for next episodes, movies, etc. You can also reach out via the Gmail. I was going to make like a pun, but there's nothing I can do with I don't know. Anyways, it's late. Gmail, it's rollitpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know. And you can always leave a scathing or pumped up review of our podcast on Apple Podcasts. Would really help us out, even if your review of our podcast is very much like my review of this movie. It's fine. I mean, maybe don't write that. Maybe email that to us. And, you know,
see give, what
us
we
something
can do.
To, give us something to fill up the deleted folder with. But
yeah.
Regardless, anything else to add, Ryan?
No, I think that just about does it. Yeah, if you want to say that, you know, the killer rules and Ty's wrong, or the killer stinks and I'm wrong, yeah, shoot us an email. But yeah, I guess all that being said, we'll see y'all in a couple weeks with something we'll figure out. Mm-hmm.